Why I Am an Atheist and Other Works, written by Bhagat Singh.
Know the Revolutionary, Bhagat Singh. In the early decades of the 20th century, the fight for India's independence was at its peak. While leaders like Mahatma Gandhi and Jawaharlal Nehru fought with non-cooperation and non-violence, the revolutionaries gave their sweat and blood to the struggle for independence. Among the many known names was a star that stood out, Bhagat Singh. Laying down his life for the nation at the tender age of 23, he became an idol for many in the years that followed. Celebrated as a young, well-read, and meticulous socialist revolutionary, his name is etched in blood in the pages of Indian history as a hero. Bhagat Singh was born in 1907 in the Punjab province under British India. His parents Kishan Singh and Vidyavati were also a part of the Indian independence movement, so needless to say, Bhagat Singh was exposed to these ideas early on in life. Since his grandfather was a follower of Arya Samaj, founded by Swami Dayanand Saraswati, Bhagat Singh was also influenced by it. He also completed his schooling from DAV High School. When he joined National College in Lahore, he was an all-rounder, studying to his heart's content and participating in dramatics and essay competitions alongside. He was deeply influenced by the socialist philosophy and founded the Indian Socialist Youth Organization, known by the name Naujawan Bharat Sabha, in March 1926. He was also a part of the Hindustan Republican Association, or HRA, along with Chandrasekhar Azad and Ram Prasad Bismil, among other well-known revolutionary freedom fighters. His family thought he was too deeply involved with the cause of freedom and needed an anchor, and hence thought of arranging his marriage. To escape the same, he ran away. He also gave a firm voice to his thoughts as he edited some Urdu and Punjabi newspapers in Amritsar. His words had the power to transform thoughts, and the British officials ended up arresting him in 1927 for his revolutionary thoughts, seeing him as a potential danger, as his ideas were influencing far too many youngsters. When the Simon Commission visited Lahore in 1928, Lala Lajpat Rai led a march to register protest against the commission. In order to disperse the crowd, the police used lathis, charging Rai in particular. Lala Lajpat Rai died of a heart stroke on 17th November 1928, and as per the doctors, it could have been due to the fatal injuries during the lathi charge. In a plan to avenge Rai's death, Bhagat Singh, along with Chandrasekhar Azad, Sukhdev Thapar, and Shivram Rajguru planned to kill Scott. But in a case of mistaken identity, they ended up killing a young ASP named J.P. Saunders. The killing was condemned by leaders like Mahatma Gandhi and several leading newspapers too, who stressed on non-cooperation and non-violence. It seemed to have soaked into the public conscience as an act of brave retaliation, making Bhagat Singh a hero. The four people behind the plan to kill Scott escaped on bicycles to their respective safe houses. They took help from other HSRA members to leave Lahore till the matter came to rest. Keeping in mind the strong search operation by the police, Bhagat Singh took to the western attire, got his hair cut after giving up the turban, a hat to cover it, and shaved off his beard. In the time that followed, Singh continuously worked on inspiring other youngsters to fight for the nation, as against worrying about their life comforts. In one such dramatic act of giving out a message, he proposed to drop bombs in the Central Legislative Assembly. Fighting against the Public Safety Bill and the Trade Dispute Act, they threw pamphlets inside the Legislative Assembly while they threw two bombs inside the corridor. The intent was to warn them and not cause any loss of life, as Singh and his comrades considered human lives as utmost importance. The pamphlet is included in the book, and you will find how they clearly mentioned their objective in the same. Bhagat Singh and Batukeshwar Dutt, who threw the bombs in the assembly, were arrested and put under trial. Singh was given life imprisonment, but this decision was suspended when the Saunders murder came into light. While under trial, they also went on hunger strikes in the jails they were held in, demanding better facilities for political prisoners. You will also read all those letters in this book. Bhagat Singh was a well-read man who knew that their revolution could only be fueled with the fire of knowledge. His letters to friends will give you an idea of the kind of books he read and also the ideologies he followed. His famous writing, Why I Am an Atheist, is a well-articulated opinion of a young man at the threshold of death. Giving the nation and fellow revolutionaries the slogan Inqilab Zindabad, he became the flag bearer of the voice of resistance to the British Raj. While most of the writings included in this book are translated from Punjabi, they will surely give you a peek into the working of a revolutionary mind. Chapter 1. Why I Am an Atheist. 5th October 1930. Bhagat Singh penned down this essay in Lahore Central Jail in 1930, in response to his religious friends who presumed that he had turned an atheist because of his vanity. They can kill me, but they cannot kill my ideas. They can crush my body, but they will not be able to crush my spirit. Bhagat Singh. A new question has cropped up. Is it due to vanity that I do not believe in the existence of an omnipotent, omnipresent, and omniscient God? I had never imagined that I would ever have to confront such a question. But conversation with some friends has given me a hint that certain of my friends, if I am not claiming too much in thinking them to be so, are inclined to conclude from the brief contact they have had with me that it was too much on my part to deny the existence of God, and that there was a certain amount of vanity that actuated my disbelief. Well, the problem is a serious one. I do not boast to be quite above these human traits. I am a man and nothing more. None can claim to be more. I also have this weakness in me. Vanity does form a part of my nature. Amongst my comrades, I was called an autocrat. Even my friend Mr. B.K. Dutt sometimes called me so. On certain occasions, I was decried as a despot. Some friends do complain, and very seriously too, that I involuntarily thrust my opinions upon others and get my proposals accepted. That this is true up to a certain extent, I do not deny. This may amount to egotism. There is vanity in me, in as much as a cult, as opposed to other popular creeds, is concerned. But that is not personal. It may be it is only legitimate pride in a cult and does not amount to vanity. Vanity, or to be more precise, ahankar, is the excess of undue pride in oneself. Whether it is such an undue pride that has led me to atheism, or whether it is after very careful study of the subject, and after much consideration that I have come to disbelieve in God, is a question that I intend to discuss here. Let me first make it clear that egotism and vanity are two different things. In the first place, I have altogether failed to comprehend as to how undue pride or vain gloriousness could ever stand in the way of a man in believing in God. I can refuse to recognize the greatness of a really great man, provided I have also achieved a certain amount of popularity, without deserving it, or without having possessed the qualities really essential or indispensable for the same purpose. That much is conceivable. But in what way can a man believing in God cease believing due to his personal vanity? There are only two ways. The man should either begin to think himself a rival of God, or he may begin to believe himself to be God. In neither case can he become a genuine atheist. In the first case, he does not even deny the existence of his rival. In the second case as well, he admits the existence of a conscious being behind the screen, guiding all the movements of nature. It is of no importance to us whether he thinks himself to be that supreme being, or whether he thinks the supreme conscious being to be somebody apart from himself. The fundamental is there. His belief is there. He is by no means an atheist. Well, here I am. I neither belong to the first category nor to the second. I deny the very existence of that almighty supreme being. Why I deny it shall be dealt with later on. Here I want to clear one thing. that it is not vanity that has actuated me to adopt the doctrines of atheism. I am neither a rival, nor an incarnation, nor the Supreme Being himself. One point is decided, that it is not vanity that has led me to this mode of thinking. Let me examine the facts to disprove this allegation. According to these friends of mine, I have grown vainglorious perhaps due to the undue popularity gained during the trials, both Delhi bomb and Lahore conspiracy cases. Well, let us see if their premises are correct. My atheism is not of so recent origin. I had stopped believing in God when I was an obscure young man, of whose existence my above-mentioned friends were not even aware. At least a college student cannot cherish any sort of undue pride which may lead him to atheism. Though a favorite with some professors and disliked by certain others, I was never an industrious or a studious boy. I could not get any chance of indulging in such feelings as vanity. I was rather a boy with a very shy nature, who had certain pessimistic dispositions about the future career. And in those days, I was not a perfect atheist. My grandfather, under whose influence I was brought up, is an orthodox Arya Samajist. An Arya Samajist is anything but an atheist. After finishing my primary education, I joined the DAV School of Lahore and stayed in its boarding house for full 1 year. There, apart from morning and evening prayers, I used to recite Gayatri Mantra for hours and hours. I was a perfect devotee in those days. Later on, I began to live with my father. He is a liberal in as much as the orthodoxy of religions is concerned. It was through his teachings that I aspire to devote my life to the cause of freedom. But he is not an atheist. He is a firm believer. He used to encourage me for offering prayers daily. So this is how I was brought up. In the non-cooperation days, I joined the National College. It was there that I began to think liberally and discuss and criticize all the religious problems, even about God. But still, I was a devout believer. By that time, I had begun to preserve the unshorn and unclipped long hair. But I could never believe in the mythology and doctrines of Sikhism or any other religion. But I had a firm faith in God's existence. Later on, I joined the Revolutionary Party. The first leader with whom I came in contact, though not convinced, could not dare to deny the existence of God. On my persistent inquiries about God, he used to say, "Pray whenever you want to." Now this is atheism, less courage required for the adoption of that creed. The second leader with whom I came in contact was a firm believer. Let me mention his name, respected comrade Sachindranath Sanyal, now undergoing life transportation in connection with the Karachi conspiracy case. From the every first page of his famous and only book, Bandi Jeevan, or Incarcerated Life, the glory of God is sung vehemently. In the last page of the second part of that beautiful book, his mystic, because of Vedantism, praises showered upon God form a very conspicuous part of his thoughts. The revolutionary leaflet distributed throughout India on January 28, 1925, was according to the prosecution story the result of his intellectual labor. Now, as is inevitable in the secret work, the prominent leader expresses his own views, which are very dear to his person, and the rest of the workers have to acquiesce in them, in spite of differences which they might have. In that leaflet, one full paragraph was devoted to praise the Almighty and his rejoicings in doing. That is all mysticism. What I wanted to point out was that the idea of disbelief had not even germinated in the Revolutionary Party. The famous Kakori martyrs, all four of them, passed their last day in prayers. Ramprasad Bismil was an orthodox Arya Samajist. Despite his wide studies in the field of socialism and communism, Rajan Lahiri could not suppress his desire of reciting hymns of the Upanishads and the Gita. I saw only one man amongst them, who never prayed and used to say, "Philosophy is the outcome of human weakness or limitation of knowledge." He is also undergoing a sentence of transportation for life. but he also never dared to deny the existence of God. Up to that period, I was only a romantic idealist revolutionary. Up till then, we were to follow. Now came the time to shoulder the whole responsibility. Due to the inevitable reaction, for some time the very existence of the party seemed impossible. Enthusiastic comrades, nay leaders, began to jeer at us. For some time I was afraid that someday I also might not be convinced of the futility of our own program. That was a turning point in my revolutionary career. Study was the cry that reverberated in the corridors of my mind. Study to enable yourself to face the arguments advanced by the opposition. Study to arm yourself with arguments in favor of your cult. I began to study. My previous faith and convictions underwent a remarkable modification. The romance of the violent methods alone, which was so prominent amongst our predecessors, was replaced by serious ideas. No more mysticism, no more blind faith. Realism became our cult. Use of force justifiable when resorted to as a matter of terrible necessity, and non-violence as policy indispensable for all mass movements. So much about methods. The most important thing was the clear conception of the ideal for which we were to fight. As there were no important activities in the field of action, I got ample opportunity to study various ideals of the word revolution. I studied Bakunin, the anarchist leader, something of Marx, the father of communism, and much of Lenin, Trotsky, and others, the men who had successfully carried out a revolution in their country. They were all atheists. Bakunin's God and State, though only fragmentary, is an interesting study of the subject. Later still, I came across a book entitled Common Sense by Nirlamba Swami. It was only a sort of mystic atheism. This subject became of utmost interest to me. By the end of 1926, I had been convinced as to the baselessness of the theory of existence of an almighty supreme being who created, guided, and controlled the universe. I had given out this disbelief of mine. I began discussion on the subjects with my friends. I had become a pronounced atheist. But what it meant will presently be discussed. In May 1927, I was arrested at Lahore. The arrest was a surprise. I was quite unaware of the fact that the police wanted me. All of a sudden, while passing through a garden, I found myself surrounded by the police. To my own surprise, I was very calm at that time. I did not feel any sensation, neither did I experience any excitement. I was taken into police custody. Next day, I was taken to the railway police lockup, where I was to pass full 1 month. After many days' conversation with the police officials, I guessed that they had some information regarding my connection with the Kakori party and my other activities in connection with the revolutionary movement. They told me that I had been to Lucknow while the trial was going on there, that I had negotiated a certain scheme about their rescue, that after obtaining their approval, we had procured some bombs, that by way of test, one of the bombs was thrown in the crowd on the occasion of Dasera, 1926. They further informed me, in my interest, that if I could give any statement throwing some light on the activities of the Revolutionary Party, I was not to be imprisoned, but on the contrary, set free and rewarded even without being produced as an approver in the court. I laughed at the proposal. It was all humbug. People holding ideas like ours do not throw bombs on their own innocent people. One fine morning, Mr. Newman, the then senior superintendent of CID, came to me, and after much sympathetic talk with me, imparted to me the extremely sad news that if I did not give any statement as demanded by them, they would be forced to send me up for trial for conspiracy to wage war in connection with Kakori case, and for brutal murders in connection with the Dasera bomb outrage. And he further informed me that they had evidence enough to get me convicted and hanged. In those days, I believed, though I was quite innocent, the police could do it if they desired. That very day, certain police officials began to persuade me to offer my prayers to God regularly both the times. Now I was an atheist. I wanted to settle for myself whether it was in the days of peace and enjoyment alone that I could boast of being an atheist, or whether during such hard times as well I could stick to those principles of mine. After great consideration, I decided that I could not lead myself to believe in and pray to God. No, I never did. That was the real test, and I came out successful. Never for a moment did I desire to save my neck at the cost of certain other things. So, I was a staunch disbeliever and have ever since been. It was not an easy job to stand that test. Belief softens the hardships, even can make them pleasant. In God, man can find very strong consolation and support. Without Him, man has to depend upon himself. To stand upon one's own legs amidst storms and hurricanes is not a child's play. At such testing moments, vanity, if any, evaporates, and man cannot dare to defy the general beliefs. If he does, then we must conclude that he has got certain other strength than mere vanity. This is exactly the situation now. Judgment is already too well known. Within a week, it is to be pronounced. What is the consolation, with the exception of the idea that I am going to sacrifice my life for a cause? A God-believing Hindu might be expecting to be reborn as a king. A Muslim or a Christian might dream of the luxuries to be enjoyed in paradise, and the reward he is to get for his sufferings and sacrifices. But what am I to expect? I know the moment the rope is fitted round my neck and rafters removed from under my feet, that will be the final moment. That will be the last moment. I, or to be more precise, my soul, as interpreted in the metaphysical terminology, shall all be finished there. Nothing further. A short life of struggle with no such magnificent end shall in itself be the reward if I have the courage to take it in that light. That is all. With no selfish motive or desire to be awarded here or hereafter, quite disinterestedly have I devoted my life to the cause of independence, because I could not do otherwise. The day we find a great number of men and women with this psychology who cannot devote themselves to anything else than the service of mankind and emancipation of the suffering humanity, that day shall inaugurate the era of liberty. Not to become a king, nor to gain any other rewards here, or in the next birth or after death in paradise, shall they be inspired to challenge the oppressors, exploiters, and tyrants, but to cast off the yoke of serfdom from the neck of humanity and to establish liberty and peace, shall they tread this to their individual selves perilous, and to their noble selves the only glorious imaginable path. Who dares to utter such an abominable epithet? To him I say either he is a fool or a knave. Let us forgive him, for he cannot realize the depth, the emotion, the sentiment, and the noble feelings that surge in that heart. His heart is dead as a mere lump of flesh. His eyes are weak, the evils of other interests having been cast over them. Self-reliance is always liable to be interpreted as vanity. It is sad and miserable, but there is no help. You go and oppose the prevailing faith. You go and criticize a hero, a great man, who is generally believed to be above criticism because he is thought to be infallible. The strength of your argument shall force the multitude to decry you as vainglorious. This is due to the mental stagnation. Criticism and independent thinking are the two indispensable qualities of a revolutionary. Because Mahatmaji is great, therefore none should criticize him. Because he has risen above, therefore everything he says, maybe in the field of politics or religion, economics or ethics, is right. Whether you are convinced or not, you must say, yes, that's true. This mentality does not lead towards progress. It is rather too obviously reactionary. Because our forefathers had set up a faith in some supreme being, the Almighty God, therefore any man who dares to challenge the validity of that faith, or the very existence of that supreme being, he shall have to be called an apostate, a renegade. If his arguments are too sound to be refuted by counter-arguments and spirit too strong to be cowed down by the threat of misfortunes that may befall him by the wrath of the Almighty, he shall be decried as vainglorious, his spirit to be denominated as vanity. Then why to waste time in this vain discussion? Why try to argue out the whole thing? This question is coming before the public for the first time, and is being handled in this matter-of-fact way for the first time. Hence, this lengthy discussion. As for the first question, I think I have cleared that it is not vanity that has led me to atheism. My way of argument has proved to be convincing or not, that is to be judged by my readers, not me. I know in the present circumstances my faith in God would have made my life easier, my burden lighter, and my disbelief in him has turned all the circumstances too dry, and the situation may assume too harsh a shape. A little bit of mysticism can make it poetical. But I do not want the help of any intoxication to meet my fate. I am a realist. I have been trying to overpower the instinct in me by the help of reason. I have not always been successful in achieving this end. But man's duty is to try and endeavor. Success depends upon chance and environments. As for the second question, that if it was not vanity, then there ought to be some reason to disbelieve the old and still prevailing faith of the existence of God. Yes, I come to that now. Reason there is. According to me, any man who has got some reasoning power at his command always tries to reason out his environments. Where direct proofs are lacking, philosophy occupies the important place. As I have already stated, a certain revolutionary friend used to say that philosophy is the outcome of human weakness. When our ancestors had leisure enough to try to solve out the mystery of this world, its past, present, and the future, its whys and wherefores, they having been terribly short of direct proofs, everybody tried to solve the problem in his own way. Hence, we find the wide differences in the fundamentals of various religious creeds, which sometimes assume very antagonistic and conflicting shapes. Not only the Oriental and Occidental philosophies differ, there are differences even amongst various schools of thoughts in each hemisphere. Amongst Oriental religions, the Muslim faith is not at all compatible with Hindu faith. In India alone, Buddhism and Jainism are sometimes quite separate from Brahmanism, in which there are again conflicting faiths as Arya Samaj and Sanatan Dharma. Charvak is still another independent thinker of the past ages. He challenged the authority of God in the old times. All these creeds differ from each other on the fundamental question, and everybody considers himself to be on the right. There lies the misfortune. Instead of using the experiments and expressions of the ancient savants and thinkers as a basis for our future struggle against ignorance, and to try to find out a solution to this mysterious problem, we, lethargical as we have proved to be, raise the hue and cry of faith, unflinching and unwavering faith to their versions, and thus are guilty of stagnation in human progress. Any man who stands for progress has to criticize, disbelieve, and challenge every item of the old faith. Item by item, he has to reason out every nook and corner of the prevailing faith. If after considerable reasoning, one is led to believe in any theory or philosophy, his faith is welcomed. His reasoning can be mistaken, wrong, misled, and sometimes fallacious. But he is liable to correction because reason is the guiding star of his life. But mere faith and blind faith is dangerous. It dulls the brain and makes a man reactionary. A man who claims to be a realist has to challenge the whole of the ancient faith. If it does not stand the onslaught of reason, it crumbles down. Then the first thing for him is to shatter the whole down and clear a space for the erection of a new philosophy. This is the negative side. After it begins the positive work in which sometimes some material of the old faith may be used for the purpose of reconstruction, as far as I am concerned, let me admit at the very outset that I have not been able to study much on this point. I had a great desire to study the Oriental philosophy, but I could not get any chance or opportunity to do the same. But so far as the negative study is under discussion, I think I am convinced to the extent of questioning the soundness of the old faith. I have been convinced as to the non-existence of a conscious supreme being who is guiding and directing the movements of nature. We believe in nature, and the whole progressive movement aims at the domination of man over nature for his service. There is no conscious power behind it to direct. This is what our philosophy is. As for the negative side, we ask a few questions from the believers. If, as you believe, there is an almighty, omnipresent, omniscient, and omnipotent God who created the earth or world, please let me know, why did he create it? This world of woes and miseries, a veritable, eternal combination of numberless tragedies, not a single soul being perfectly satisfied. Pray, don't say that it is his law. If he is bound by any law, he is not omnipotent. He is another slave like ourselves. Please don't say that it is his enjoyment. Nero burnt one Rome. He killed a very limited number of people. He created very few tragedies, all to his perfect enjoyment. And what is his place in history? By what names do the historians mention him? All the venomous epithets are showered upon him. Pages are blackened with invective diatribes condemning Nero, the tyrant, the heartless, the wicked. One Genghis Khan sacrificed a few thousand lives to seek pleasure in it, and we hate the very name. Then how are you going to justify your almighty, eternal Nero, who has been and is still causing numberless tragedies every day, every hour, and every minute? How do you think to support his misdoings, which surpass those of Genghis every single moment? I say, why did he create this world? A veritable hell, a place of constant and bitter unrest. Why did the Almighty create man when he had the power not to do it? What is the justification for all this? Do you say to award the innocent sufferers hereafter and to punish the wrongdoers as well? Well, well, how far shall you justify a man who may dare to inflict wounds upon your body to apply a very soft and soothing liniment upon it afterwards? How far the supporters and organizers of the gladiator institution were justified in throwing men before the half-starved, furious lions to be cared for and well looked after if they could survive and manage to escape death by the wild beasts? That is why I ask, why did the conscious supreme being create this world and man in it? To seek pleasure? Where then is the difference between him and Nero? You Mohammedans and Christians, Hindu philosophy shall still linger on to offer another argument. I ask you, what is your answer to the above-mentioned question? You don't believe in previous birth. Like Hindus, you cannot advance the argument of previous misdoings of the apparently quite innocent sufferers. I ask you, why did the omnipotent labor for 6 days to create the world through word, and each day to say that all was well? Call him today. Show him the past history. Make him study the present situation. Let us see if he dares to say, all is well. From the dungeons of prisons, from the stores of starvation consuming millions upon millions of human beings in slums and huts, from the exploited laborers patiently or say apathetically watching the procedure of their blood being sucked by the capitalist vampires, and the wastage of human energy that will make a man with the least common sense shiver with horror, and from the preference of throwing the surplus of production in oceans rather than to distribute amongst the needy producers, to the palaces of kings built upon the foundation laid with human bones. Let him see all this, and let him say all is well. Why, and wherefore? That is my question. You are silent. All right then, I proceed. Well, you Hindus, you say all the present sufferers belong to the class of sinners of the previous births. Good. You say the present oppressors were saintly people in their previous births, hence they enjoy power. Let me admit that your ancestors were very shrewd people. They tried to find out theories strong enough to hammer down all the efforts of reason and disbelief. But let us analyze how far this argument can really stand. From the point of view of the most famous jurists, punishment can be justified only from three or four ends to meet which it is inflicted upon the wrongdoer. They are retributive, reformative, and deterrent. The retributive theory is now being condemned by all the advanced thinkers. Deterrent theory is also following the same fate. Reformative theory is the only one which is essential and indispensable for human progress. It aims at returning the offender as a most competent and a peace-loving citizen to the society. But what is the nature of punishment inflicted by God upon men, even if we suppose them to be offenders? You say he sends them to be born as a cow, a cat, a tree, a herb, or a beast. You enumerate these punishments to be 84 lakhs. I ask you, what is its reformative effect upon man? How many men have met you who say that they were born as a donkey in previous birth for having committed any sin? None. Don't quote your Puranas. I have no scope to touch your mythologies. Moreover, do you know that the greatest sin in this world is to be poor? Poverty is a sin. It is a punishment. I ask you, how far would you appreciate a criminologist, a jurist, or a legislator who proposes such measures of punishment which shall inevitably force man to commit more offenses? Had not your God thought of this, or he also had to learn these things by experience, but at the cost of untold sufferings to be borne by humanity? What do you think shall be the fate of a man who has been born in a poor and illiterate family of, say, a chamar or a sweeper? He is poor, hence he cannot study. He is hated and shunned by his fellow human beings who think themselves to be his superiors, having been born in a higher caste. His ignorance, his poverty, and the treatment meted out to him shall harden his heart towards society. Suppose he commits a sin. Who shall bear the consequences? God? He or the learned ones of the society? What about the punishment of those people who were deliberately kept ignorant by the haughty and egotist Brahmins, and who had to pay the penalty by bearing the stream of being led, not lead, in their ears, for having heard a few sentences of your sacred books of learning, the Vedas? If they committed any offense, who was to be responsible for them, and who was to bear the brunt? My dear friends, these theories are the inventions of the privileged ones. They justify their usurped power, riches, and superiority by the help of these theories. Yes, it was perhaps Upton Sinclair that wrote at some place that just make a man a believer in immortality, and then rob him of all his riches and possessions. He shall help you even in that ungrudgingly. The coalition amongst the religious preachers and possessors of power brought forth jails, gallows, knouts, and these theories. I ask, why your omnipotent God does not stop every man when he is committing any sin or offense? He can do it quite easily. Why did he not kill warlords or kill the fury of war in them, and thus avoid the catastrophe hurled down on the head of humanity by the Great War? Why does he not just produce a certain sentiment in the mind of the British people to liberate India? Why does he not infuse the altruistic enthusiasm in the hearts of all capitalists to forego their rights of personal possessions of means of production, and thus redeem the whole laboring community, nay, the whole human society from the bondage of capitalism? You want to reason out the practicability of socialist theory. I leave it for your Almighty to enforce it. People recognize the merits of socialism in as much as the general welfare is concerned. They oppose it under the pretext of its being impracticable. Let the Almighty step in and arrange everything in an orderly fashion. Now don't try to advance roundabout arguments. They are out of order. Let me tell you, British rule is here not because God wills it, but because they possess power, and we do not dare to oppose them. Not that it is with the help of God that they are keeping us under this subjection, but it is with the help of guns and rifles, bomb and bullets, police and militia, and our apathy, that they are successfully committing the most deplorable sin against society, the outrageous exploitation of one nation by another. Where is God? What is he doing? Is he enjoying all these woes of human race? A Nero, a Chengiz, down with him. Do you ask me how I explain the origin of this world and origin of man? All right, I will tell you. Charles Darwin has tried to throw some light on the subject. Study him. Read Soham Swami's Common Sense. It shall answer your question to some extent. This is a phenomenon of nature. The accidental mixture of different substances in the shape of nebulae produced this earth. When? Consult history. The same process produced animals and, in the long run, man. Read Darwin's Origin of Species. And all the later progress is due to man's constant conflict with nature and his efforts to override it. This is the briefest possible explanation of this phenomenon. Your other argument may be just to ask why a child is born blind or lame, if not due to his deeds committed in the previous birth. This problem has been explained away by biologists as a more biological phenomenon. According to them, the whole burden rests upon the shoulders of the parents, who may be conscious or ignorant of their own deeds that led to mutilation of the child previous to its birth. Naturally, you may ask another question. Though it is quite childish in essence, if no God existed, how did the people come to believe in him? My answer is clear and brief. As they came to believe in ghosts and evil spirits, the only difference is that belief in God is almost universal and the philosophy well developed. Unlike certain of the radicals, I would not attribute its origin to the ingenuity of the exploiters who wanted to keep the people under their subjection by preaching the existence of a supreme being and then claiming an authority and sanction from him for their privileged positions. Though I do not differ with them on the essential point that all faiths, religions, creeds, and such other institutions became in turn the mere supporters of the tyrannical and exploiting institutions, men and classes. Rebellion against king is always a sin according to every religion. As regards the origin of God, my own idea is that having realized the limitations of man, his weaknesses and shortcoming having been taken into consideration, God was brought into imaginary existence to encourage man to face boldly all the trying circumstances, to meet all dangers manfully, and to check and restrain his outbursts in prosperity and affluence. God, both with his private laws and parental generosity, was imagined and painted in greater details. He was to serve as a deterrent factor when his fury and private laws were discussed, so that man may not become a danger to society. He was to serve as a father, mother, sister and brother, friend and helpers when his parental qualifications were to be explained, so that when man be in great distress, having been betrayed and deserted by all friends, he may find consolation in the idea that an ever-true friend was still there to help him, to support him and that he was almighty and could do anything. Really, that was useful to the society in the primitive age. The idea of God is helpful to a man in distress. Society has to fight out this belief as well as idol worship and the narrow conception of religion. Similarly, when man tries to stand on his own legs and become a realist, he shall have to throw the faith aside and to face manfully all the distress, trouble in which the circumstances may throw him. That is exactly my state of affairs. It is not my vanity, my friends. It is my mode of thinking that has made me an atheist. I don't know whether in my case belief in God and offering of daily prayers, which I consider to be most selfish and degraded act on the part of man, can prove to be helpful, or they shall make my case worse still. I have read of atheists facing all troubles quite boldly. So am I trying to stand like a man with an erect head to the last, even on the gallows? Let us see how I carry on. One friend asked me to pray. When informed of my atheism, he said, "During your last days, you will begin to believe." I said, "No, dear sir, it shall not be. I will think that to be an act of degradation and demoralization on my part. For selfish motives, I am not going to pray." Readers and friends, is this vanity? If it is, I stand for it. Chapter 2. I would not defend myself. 4th October 1930. Bhagat Singh wrote this letter to his father Sardar Kishan Singh when he found out that the latter was trying to prove him innocent in the case of Saunders' death. His father had made a written request to the Tribunal of Lahore conspiracy case stating that Bhagat Singh be given a chance to prove his innocence. The sword of revolution is sharpened on the whetting stone of ideas. Bhagat Singh. My dear father, I was astounded to learn that you had submitted a petition to the members of the special tribunal in connection with my defense. This intelligence proved to be too severe a blow to be borne with equanimity. It has upset the whole equilibrium of my mind. I have not been able to understand how you could think it proper to submit such a petition at this stage and in these circumstances. In spite of all the sentiments and feelings of a father, I don't think you are at all entitled to make such a move on my behalf without even consulting me. You know that in the political field, my views have always differed with those of yours. I have always been acting independently without having cared for your approval or disapproval. I hope you can recall to yourself that since the very beginning, you have been trying to convince me to fight my case very seriously and to defend myself properly. But you also know that I was always opposed to it. I never had any desire to defend myself and never did I seriously think about it. Whether it was a mere vague ideology or that I had certain arguments to justify my position is a different question and that cannot be discussed here. You know that we have been pursuing a definite policy in this trial. Every action of mine ought to have been consistent with that policy, my principle, and my program. At present, the circumstances are altogether different. But had the situation been otherwise, even then, I would have been the last man to offer defense. I had only one idea before me throughout the trial, that is to show complete indifference towards the trial, in spite of the serious nature of the charges against us. I have always been of the opinion that all the political workers should be indifferent and should never bother about the legal fight in the law courts and should boldly bear the heaviest possible sentences inflicted upon them. They may defend themselves, but always from purely political considerations and never from a personal point of view. Our policy in this trial has always been consistent with this principle. Whether we were successful in that or not is not for me to judge. We have always been doing our duty quite disinterestedly. In the statement accompanying the text of Lahore conspiracy case ordinance, the Viceroy had stated that the accused in this case were trying to bring both law and justice into contempt. The situation afforded us an opportunity to show to the public whether we were trying to bring law into contempt or whether others were doing so. People might disagree with us on this point. You might be one of them, but that never meant that such moves should be made on my behalf without my consent or even my knowledge. My life is not so precious, at least to me, as you may probably think it to be. It is not at all worth buying at the cost of my principles. There are other comrades of mine whose case is as serious as that of mine. We had adopted a common policy, and we shall stand to the last, no matter how dearly we have to pay individually for it. Father, I am quite perplexed. I fear I might overlook the ordinary principle of etiquette, and my language may become a little bit harsh while criticizing or rather censoring this move on your part. Let me be candid. I feel as though I have been stabbed in the back. Had any other person done it, I would have considered it to be nothing short of treachery. But in your case, let me say that it has been a weakness of the worst type. This was the time where everybody's mettle was being tested. Let me say, Father, you have failed. I know you are as sincere a patriot as one can be. I know you have devoted your life to the cause of Indian independence. But why, at this moment, have you displayed such a weakness? I cannot understand. In the end, I would like to inform you and my other friends and all the people interested in my case that I have not approved of your move. I am still not at all in favor of offering any defense. Even if the court had accepted that petition submitted by some of my co-accused regarding defense, etc., I would have not defended myself. My applications submitted to the tribunal regarding my interview during the hunger strike were misinterpreted, and it was published in the press that I was going to offer defense, though in reality I was never willing to offer any defense. I still hold the same opinion as before. My friends in the Borstal jail will be taking it as a treachery and betrayal on my part. I shall not even get an opportunity to clear my position before them. I want that public should know all the details about this complication, and therefore I request you to publish this letter. Your loving son, Bhagat Singh. Chapter 3. Letter to Shaheed Sukhdev. 5th April 1929. Written by Bhagat Singh in Sitaram Bazaar in Delhi, this letter was delivered to Sukhdev in Lahore by Shiv Verma, only to be recovered from him at the time of his arrest a week later. Revolution is an inalienable right of mankind. Freedom is an imperishable birthright of all. Bhagat Singh. Dear brother, by the time you receive this letter, I will be gone, going to a far-off destination. Let me assure that I am prepared for the voyage in spite of all the sweet memories and in spite of all the charms of my life here. Up to this day, one thing pinched in my heart, and it was this, that my brother, my own brother, misunderstood and accused me of a very serious charge, the charge of weakness. Today I am quite satisfied. Today more than ever do I feel that was nothing but a misunderstanding, a wrong calculation. My over-frankness was interpreted as my talkativeness, and my confession as my weakness. And now I feel it was misunderstanding and only misunderstanding. I am not weak, not weaker than anyone amongst us, brother. With a clear heart, I go. Will you clear too? It will be very kind of you. But note that you are to take no hasty step. Soberly and calmly, you are to carry on the work. Don't try to take the chance at the very outset. You have some duty towards the public, and that you can fulfill by continuing this work. As a suggestion, I would say that M.R. Shastri appeals to me more than ever. Try to bring him into the arena, provided he himself may be willing, clearly knowing the dark future. Let him mix with men and study their psychology. If he will work in the right spirit, he will be the better judge. Arrange as you may deem fit. Now, brother, let us be happy. By the way, I must say that I cannot help arguing once again my case in the matter under discussion. Again do I emphasize that I am full of ambition and hope and of full charm of life. But I can renounce all at the time of need, and that is the real sacrifice. These things can never be hindrance in the way of man, provided he be a man. You will have the practical proof in the near future. While discussing anybody's character, you asked me one thing, whether love ever proved helpful to any man. Yes, I answer that question today. To Mazzini it was. You must have read that after the utter failure and crushing defeat of his first rising, he could not bear the misery and haunting ideas of his dead comrades. He would have gone mad or committed suicide, but for one letter of a girl he loved. He would feel as strong as anyone, nay, stronger than all. As regards the moral status of love, I may say that it in itself is nothing but passion, not an animal passion, but a human one, and very sweet too. Love in itself can never be an animal passion. Love always elevates the character of man. It never lowers him, provided love be love. You can't call these girls mad people, as we generally see in films, lovers. They always play in the hands of animal passions. The true love cannot be created. It comes of its own accord. Nobody can say when. It is but natural. And I may tell you that a young man and a young girl can love each other, and with the aid of their love they can overcome the passions themselves and can maintain their purity. I may clear one thing here. When I said that love has human weakness, I did not say it for an ordinary human being at this stage, where the people generally are. But that is the most idealistic stage when man would overcome all these sentiments, the love, the hatred, and so on, when man will take reason as the sole basis of his activity. But at present, it is not bad, rather good and useful to man. And moreover, while rebuking the love, I rebuked the love of one individual for one, and that too in idealistic stage. And even then, man must have the strongest feelings of love which he may not confine to one individual and may make it universal. Now I think I have cleared my position. One thing I may tell you to mark, we in spite of all radical ideas that we cherish have not been able to do away with the over-idealistic Arya-Samajist conception of morality. We may talk glibly about all the radical things that can possibly be conceived, but in practical life we begin to tremble at the very outset. This I will request you, do away with. And may I, without fear at all the misapprehension in my mind, request you, do kindly lower the standard of your over-idealism a bit, not to be harsh to those who will live behind and will be the victims of a disease as myself. Don't rebuke them and thus add to their woes and misery. They need your sympathy. May I repeat that you, without bearing any sort of grudge against any particular individual, will sympathize with those who need it the most? But you cannot realize these things unless and until you yourself fall a victim to this. But why am I writing all this? I wanted to be frank. I have cleared my heart. Wish you all success and happy life. Yours, B.S. Chapter 4. The Red Pamphlet. 8th April, 1929. This leaflet was left all across the Central Assembly Hall by Bhagat Singh and Batukeshwar Dutt after they threw two bombs in the assembly corridor. Old orders should change, always and ever, yielding place to new, so that one good order may not corrupt the world. Bhagat Singh. The Hindustan Socialist Republican Army notice. It takes a loud voice to make the deaf hear. With these immortal words uttered on a similar occasion by Valiant, a French anarchist martyr, do we strongly justify this action of ours. Without repeating the humiliating history of the past 10 years of the working of the reforms, Montague-Chelmsford reforms, and without mentioning the insults hurled at the Indian nation through this house, the so-called Indian Parliament, we want to point out that while the people expecting some more crumbs of reforms from the Simon Commission and are ever quarrelling over the distribution of the expected bones, the government is thrusting upon us new repressive measures like the Public Safety and the Trade Disputes Bill.